And it was the three-footer that was stolen, I said. He looked at me like I was clairvoyant. Detective Clark showed us the sample you lent him, I said.
I see, he said.
So is the 36-inch three-quarter section Fortis a rare item? He made a face, like he was a little disappointed.
I sell one a year, he said. Two, if I'm very lucky. They're expensive, and appreciation for quality is declining shamefully. Pearls before swine, I say.
Is that the same everywhere?
Everywhere?
He repeated. You know, the stores, regionally, with the Fortis crowbars.
Oh, I'm sorry, he said. Perhaps I didn't make myself quite clear. They're made for me, to my own design, to my own exact specification. They're custom items.
I stared at him. They're exclusive to this store? He nodded.
The privilege of independence.
Literally exclusive. He nodded again.
Unique in all the world.
When did you last sell one?
About 9 months ago.
Does the paint wear off?
I know what you're asking, he said. The answer's yes, of course. If you find one that looks new, it's the one that was stolen on New Year's Eve.
We borrowed an identical sample from him for comparative purposes, the same way Detective Clark had. It was dewed with machine oil and had tissue paper wrapped around the center shaft. We laid it like a trophy across the Chevy's back seat. Then we ate in the car, burgers from a drive-thru 100 yards north of the tool store. Tell me three new facts, I said.
One, Miss Kramer and Carbone were killed by the same individual weapon. Two, we're gonna drive ourselves nuts trying to find a connection between them.
And three?
I don't know.
Three, the bad guy knew Sperryville pretty well. Could you have found that store in the dark in a hurry, unless you knew the town? We looked ahead through the windshield. The mouth of the alley was just about visible. But then we knew it was there, and it was full daylight. Summer closed her eyes.
Focus on a weapon, she said. Forget everything else. Visualize it. The custom crowbar. Unique in all the world. It was carried out of that alley right there. Then it was in Green Valley at 2 a.m. on January 1st. And then it was inside Fort Byrd at 9 p.m. on the 4th. It went on a journey. We know where it started, and we know where it finished. We don't know for sure where it went in between, but we do know for certain it passed one particular point along the way. It passed Fort Byrd's main gate. We don't know when, but we know for sure that it did.
She opened her eyes.
We have to get back there, she said. We have to look at the logs again. The earliest it could have passed the gate is 6 a.m. on January 1st because Byrd is 4 hours from Green Valley. The latest it could have passed the gate, say, 8 p.m. on January 4th. That's an 86-hour window. We need to check the gate logs for everybody who entered during that time. Because we know for sure that the crowbar came in, and we know for sure that it didn't walk in by itself.
I said nothing.
I'm sorry, she said. There'll be a lot of names.
The truant feeling was completely gone. We got back on the road and headed east, looking for I-95. We found it, and we turned south, towards Byrd, towards Willard on the phone. Towards the angry Delta station. We slid back under the shelf of gray cloud just before the North Carolina state line. The sky went dark. Summer put the headlights on. We passed the state police building on the opposite shoulder, past the spot where Kramer's briefcase had been found, past the rest area a mile later. We merged with the east-west highway spur and came off at the cloverleaf next to Kramer's motel. We left it behind us and drove the 30 miles down to Fort Byrd's gate. The guard shack MPs signed us in at 19:30 hours exactly. I told them to copy their logs starting at 0600 hours January 1st and ending at 2000 hours January 4th. I told them to have a Xerox record of that 86-hour slice of life delivered to my office immediately. My office was very quiet. The morning mayhem was long gone. A sergeant with the baby son was back on duty. She looked tired. I realized she didn't sleep much. She worked all night and probably played with her kid all day. Tough life. She had coffee going. I figured she was just as interested in it as I was. Maybe more.
Delta guys are restless, she said. They know you arrested the Bulgarian guy.
I didn't arrest him. I just asked him some questions.
That's a distinction they don't seem willing to make. People have been in and out of here looking for you.
Were they armed?
They don't need to be armed. Not those guys. You should have them confined to quarters. You could do that. You're acting MPCO here.
I shook my head. Anything else?
You need to call Colonel Willard before midnight or he's going to write you up as AWOL. He said that's a promise.
I nodded. It was Willard's obvious next move. An AWOL charge wouldn't reflect badly on a CO, wouldn't make him look like he'd lost his grip. An AWOL charge was always on the man who ran, fair and square. Anything else, I said again?
Sanchez wants a 1016, she said, down at Fort Jackson, and your brother called again.
Any message, I said.
No message.
Okay, I said. I went inside to my desk, picked up my phone. Summer stepped over to the map, traced her fingers across the pins. D.C. to Sperryville, Sperryville to Green Valley, Green Valley to Fort Byrd. I dialed Joe's number. He answered second ring. I called Mom, he said. She's still hanging in there. She said soon, Joe. Doesn't mean we have to mount a daily vigil. Bound to be sooner than we think, and than we want. How was she? She sounded shaky. You okay? Not bad, he said. You? Not a great year so far. You should call her next, he said. I will, I said. In a few days. Do it tomorrow, he said. He hung up, and I sat for a minute. Then I dabbed the cradle to clear the line and asked my sergeant to get Sanchez for me, down at Jackson. I held the phone by my ear and waited. Summer was looking right at me.
A daily vigil?
She said. She's waiting for the plaster to come off, I said. She doesn't like it. Summer looked at me a little more, then turned back to the map. I put the phone on speaker and laid the handset down on the desk. There was a click on the line, and we heard Sanchez's voice.
I've been hassling the Columbia PD about Brubaker's car, he said. Didn't they find it yet? I said. No, he said. And they weren't putting any effort into finding it, which was inconceivable to me, so I kept on hassling them. And? They dropped the other shoe. Which is? Brubaker wasn't killed in Columbia, he said. He was dumped there is all.
Sanchez told us the Columbia medical examiners had found confused lividity patterns on Brubaker's body that, in their opinion, meant he'd been dead about 3 hours before being tossed in the alley. Lividity is what happens to a person's blood after death. The heart stops, blood pressure collapses, liquid blood drains and sinks and settles into the lowest parts of the body under the simple force of gravity. It rests there, and over a period of time, it stains the skin liverish purple. Somewhere between 3 and 6 hours later, the color fixes permanently, like a developed photograph. A guy who falls down dead on his back will have a pale chest and a purple back. Vice versa for a guy who falls down dead on his front. But Brubaker's lividity was all over the place. The Columbia medical examiners figured he'd been killed, then kept on his back for about 3 hours, then dumped in the alley on his front. They were pretty confident about their estimate of the 3 hour duration, because 3 hours was the point where the stains would first start to fix. They said he had signs of early fixed lividity on his back and major fixed lividity on his front. They also said he had a broad stripe across the middle of his back where the dead flesh had been partially cooked. He was in the trunk of a car, I said.
Right over the muffler, Sanchez said. 3-hour journey, plenty of temperature.
This changes a lot of things.
It explains why they never found his Chevy in Colombia.
Or any witnesses, I said. Or the shell cases or the bullets.
So what are we looking at?
3 hours in a car, I said, at night, with empty roads. Anything up to a 200-mile radius.
That's a pretty big circle, Sanchez said.
125,000 square miles, I said, approximately. Pi times radius squared. What's a Columbia PD doing about it?
Dropping it like a hot potato. It's an FBI case now.
What does the Bureau think about the dope thing?
Well, they're a little skeptical. They figure heroin isn't our bag. They figure we're more into marijuana and amphetamines.
I wish, I said, I could use a little of both right now.
On the other hand, they know Delta guys go all over. Pakistan, South America, which is where heroin comes from. So they'll keep it in their back pocket in case they don't get anywhere, just like the Columbia PD was going to.
They're wasting their time. Heroin? Guy like Brubaker would die first.
They're thinking maybe he did.
His end of the line clicked off. I killed the speaker and put the handset back.
It happened in the north, probably,
Summer said.
Brubaker started out in Raleigh. We should be looking for his car somewhere up there.
Not our case, I said.
Okay, the FBI should be looking.
I'm sure they already are. There was a knock at the door. It opened up and an MP corporal came in with sheets of paper under his arm. He saluted smartly and stepped a pace forward and placed the sheets of paper on my desk. Stepped the same pace back and saluted again.
Copies of the gate log, sir, he said. First through fourth of this month, times as requested.
He turned around and walked back out of the room. Closed the door. I looked at the pile of paper. There were about 7 sheets in it. Not too bad. Let's go to work, I said. Operation Just Cause helped us again. The raised DEFCON level meant a lot of leave had been canceled. No real reason, because the Panama thing was no kind of a big deal, but that was how the military worked. No point in having DEFCON levels if they couldn't be raised up and dropped down. No point in moving them at all if there weren't any associated consequences. No point in staging little foreign dramas unless the whole establishment felt a remote and vicarious thrill. No point in canceling leave without giving people something to fill their time, either. So there were extra training sessions and daily readiness exercises. Most of them were arduous and started early. Therefore, the big bonus for us was that almost everyone who'd gone out to celebrate New Year's Eve was back on post and in the rack relatively early. They must have straggled back around 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning, because there was very little gate activity recorded after 6. Incoming personnel during the 18 hours we were looking at on New Year's Day totaled 19. Summer and I were 2 of them, returning from Green Valley and D.C. after the widow trip and the visit to Walter Reed. We crossed ourselves off the list. Incoming personnel other than ourselves on January 2nd totaled 16. 12 on January 3rd. 17 before 2000 hours on January 4th. 62 names in total during the 86-hour window. 9 of them were civilian delivery drivers. We crossed them off. 11 of them were repeats. They had come in, gone out, come in again, like commuters. My night duty sergeant was one of them. We crossed her off because she was a woman, and short. Elsewhere, we deleted the second and any subsequent entries in each case. We ended up with 41 individuals, listed by name, rank, and initial. No way of telling which were men and which were women. no way of telling which of the men were tall and strong and right-handed.
I work on the genders, Summer said. I've still got the basic strength lists. They have full names on them.
I nodded, left her to it. Got on the phone and scared up the pathologist and asked him to meet me in the mortuary right away.